for more details. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Honey Masood, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Daniel Begun and Anna Osbeck and Sam Riddell. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineer. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland performance of Carla Lara, Thursday, October 23rd, from 7 to 10 p.m. Carla Lara, Honduran jazz singer, songwriter, and political activist, will be performing at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. She is a working artist, journalist, and feminist in a country where resistance in her artistic life has always been tied to political life in Central America. That's Carla Lara. Thursday, October 23rd, from 7 to 10 p.m. at Tabor Space in Portland. More information about this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center. While cinema provides entertainment and escape, for many filmmakers and viewers it is a vital portal into the lives of others, a medium of engagement, and a powerful tool for social action. Films will be shown from Thursday, October 6th through Wednesday, November 9th, and include the films Familia, Sing Your Song, An African Election, Windfall, and more. Again, that's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center, located at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information about the films can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com.
Now Jackie Jill went up the hill to join the labor rights. They couldn't pay the water bills, but that was alright. They thought they'd get a buzz from B, a member of the party, so they could crash their ballot box, but that's another story. All I wanna be, something plain to see. Nothing special but it, just a priority. Just a vacancy, it's not the way to be. You've gotta find a place in life. A nursery rhyme is really like a politician's speech. Makes as much sense as counting pebbles on a beach. And if you don't believe me, then check the manifesto. Just blah 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 and blah blah blah. The truth, I don't think so. All I wanna be, something plain to see. Nothing special but just a priority. Just a vacancy, it's not the way to be. You gotta find a place in life.
And good morning. You are listening to Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. I'm your regular host at this time. We bring you talk radio Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 a.m. here on this non-commercial listener-sponsored community radio station. You know, an hour is not a whole lot of time. It always seems like you kind of just get going and then it's winding down. But we do what we can, and We also have other opportunities. Even on some of the music shows, there's the, you know, in the morning, we have opportunities for call-ins occasionally. Parafagarine does sometimes. And on Thursday, during his show, and some other people, as I say, do. So, and we also always welcome your comments. The number in the air room, the studio line is 503-231-8187. You know, always feel free to call up the DJ, ask them what it is that they're playing, and come on down and get involved. We just had a volunteer orientation this past Saturday, a packed room as usual, and you can also get involved that way. The last three weeks I've had guests, and I often do have guests. This morning I don't. If you're a regular listener to this show in particular, you've probably caught some previous shows where I was trying to go in a certain direction with this program, and I'd kind of like to get back to that a little bit, explain a little more about what I've got in mind, see if this is something that you want to participate in yourself. My interest, I'm a longtime activist myself, and I think I believe that the power of this medium that we have, the way we use it anyway, I don't think generally that's true. Most media sources are very one way, and I'm interested in trying to make it more participatory, really use this as sort of a model of the society that we want to live in. I want to actually conduct my life and my endeavors in a way that I believe that that's the way we should live. And I believe in participatory democracy. I don't believe in delegating authority or decision-making to others. Hence, I'm not a huge fan of the representative form of so-called democracy that we have in this country. I believe we really have to take very seriously experimenting with and engaging in decision-making on a community level instead of delegating it to elected representatives. I say that also because we have an election coming up. Of course, Oregon is somewhat unique in our use of the ballot initiative process, and there are a lot of interesting ballot initiatives. And I think, even though I think we should also get back towards controlling our lives in a much more direct way, I think we do have to use the forms that are here. So I'm not against voting, and I'm certainly not against using the initiative process. And I think we've talked about a lot of them on KBOO already, the GMO initiative. I think it's pretty obvious that we need that it's our right to know what's in our food. I tend to be against that initiative. I believe it's number 70 for the voting for the top two candidates in the primaries. And, I'm not going to go down them because we talked about them a lot. Maybe someone will want to talk about one of them during this program. So anyway, I played that song, We All Need a Place in the World, because my point of view, my perspective on things tends to be very place-oriented. I consider myself a bioregionalist. I have a soft spot in my heart for this idea of Cascadia, sort of redefining the region that we live in to be different from these artificial borders. I know Joe Uris, I don't know if people listened to Joe Uris's talk show yesterday, where he had a guest there talking about the Kurdistan in four different countries, Kurdish population, that they're separated by artificial national boundaries with the carving up of the Ottoman Empire. Well, you know, the same thing happened here. I think we tend to forget about that actually there were indigenous nations here for thousands of years, hundreds, thousands of years, and they actually were getting along quite well without us. And I say us in general. I guess I shouldn't include everybody in that, because I'm sure there's some of you out there who aren't predominantly of Euro-American extraction, but I am. My ancestors come from Italy, Denmark, and Germany. And my dad was an immigrant to this country from Italy. And my mom's family kind of hopscotched across the United States from Western Virginia and ended up in Kansas. They're kind of on the sort of on the leading edge of the frontier, sometimes fighting against the Native Americans, sometimes just opportunistically settling on the land that had been expropriated from the Native Americans by the conquest of empire or manifest destiny. And we are the heirs of that. And I kind of bring this up also because in a couple weeks, I'm going to be interviewing Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on this program. Her incredible new book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States. I would encourage people to go out and get a copy now. I think it's something well worth having ongoing discussions around. I like to do that on this program. And she basically just lays it out. She argues that we are still in a colonial framework. You know, all the discussions about how to, what kind of society we want to live in, what kind of political system, talk about the elections from a point of view that is extremely difficult to argue with in my perspective. This is an illegitimate form of government. And, you know, I've argued from various perspectives for a what I consider a more radical, which means to the roots, outlook, historical outlook. I've had Thomas Lindsay from the Community Rights Movement, as well as Paul Cienfuegos, their local activist here, one of them anyway, to talk about the illegitimacy of the whole regulatory framework that has been set up to supposedly protect us from corporate toxic pollution by corporations, other activities that are harmful socially, environmentally, and how it just doesn't work. It was basically rigged from the very beginning with the Commerce Clause of the Constitution that enabled corporate power to gain a foothold, and through various decisions of the Supreme Court, lastly, but certainly not the most important, even Citizens United, but it goes way back to the early days of this country. And so, again, I'll be interviewing Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who's a longtime Indigenous rights activist on mostly an international level, but she's been a writer. She's written a lot of really powerful things. So, yeah, so I want to talk about that a little bit because, again, I'm sort of going around a bit in this introduction here, but what I'm trying to do with this program, and I think I've said this in other occasions, is, as I said, I'm really focused on place. I think we need to take a stand where we are. I think we need to form decision-making bodies on a community level. We need to take back the power on a community level. The vision, the bi-regional vision, is a watershed-based vision, watershed-based councils. I know those watershed councils have been co-opted, as all our best ideas tend to be, by the power structure, because the power structure really doesn't have any new good ideas on its own. It's basically worn out. All it can survive on is by sucking off the energy of the labor, the physical labor, mental labor, and good ideas of the people that are caught in it. And so we need to take that back for ourselves and stop giving over power and stop participating to the extent that we're able. It's a long haul. And that's what I'm trying to do with this program, because KBOO basically goes out to a fairly wide area. It goes up into Southwest Washington, goes down to the Willamette Valley, goes out towards Mount Hood. We have a translator in the Columbia River Gorge up in Hood River. And so I think we I would like to use this to actually directly bring people together in some way that I'm not sure where it's going to go. I'm interested in people. I'm interested in what people are doing along these lines, what kind of projects that people are doing to resist corporate power, to reinvigorate community life. And I would like to talk about that on the air. I'd like to also the outerlying areas of our signal, we don't tend to hear too much from people out there. So I'd really like to hear from people, what people are doing. So those are a few ideas I have. The number is 503-231-8187. You know, it's really up to you. I know a lot of times people are responding to, you know, guests that we have on, and that's good because I think it's important to bring various perspectives. That's one thing that KBOO does, is it brings perspectives that you don't tend to hear on the rest of the media very often anyway. And so that's very valuable. But I also think we need to really think for ourselves and use these airwaves to strategize and move somewhere together. So that's the challenge. If you have anything you want to talk about along those lines or others, give us a call. I also want to talk about this recent article by Chris Hedges called The Imperative of Revolt. And he's talking about sort of from a different angle, a little bit about what I've been talking about. He says he met with Sheldon Wolin in Salem, Oregon, and John Ralston Saul in Toronto and asked the two political philosophers the same question. If, as Saul has written, we have undergone a corporate coup d'etat and now live under a species of corporate dictatorship that Wolin calls, in quote, inverted totalitarianism. And you can read about all these on a Truth Dig. If the internal mechanisms that once made piecemeal and incremental reform possible remain ineffective, if corporate power retains its chokehold on our economy and governance, including our legislative bodies, judiciary, and systems of information, and if these corporate forces are able to use the security and surveillance apparatus and militarized police forces to criminalize dissent, how will change occur and what will it look like? That's basically a question that I've posed numerous times over the past weeks. And, you know, the idea, I think we just tend to, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I never was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, although I could have been. I know a lot of people who have been, but they talk about magical thinking and stinking thinking. This idea that sort of things will sort of magically get better. You know, the alcoholic is grasping at straws, just sort of thinking that, they don't really have a problem. They can take that next drink and they're not going to take another one after that, et cetera, et cetera. They don't really need help. And I think that's, you know, there is an analogy to the society in general. I think we have these, you know, we just sort of accept the structures of power and decision making that we live with, and we think somehow we will be able to use them to make the changes necessary, even though the world continues to go down the path it's on with these structures. And so it's kind of a paradox. So Chris Hedges continues, Wolin, who wrote the books Politics and Vision and Democracy Incorporated, and Saul, who wrote Voltaire's Bastards and the Unconscious Civilization, see democratic rituals and institutions, especially in the United States, as largely a facade for unchecked global corporate power. Wolin and Saul excoriate academics, intellectuals, and journalists, charging they have abrogated their calling to expose abuses of power and give voice to social criticism. They instead function as echo chambers for elites, courtiers, and corporate systems managers. Neither believes the current economic system is sustainable, and each calls for mass movements willing to carry out repeated acts of civil disobedience to disrupt and delegitimize corporate power. If you continue to go down the wrong road, at a certain point something happens, Saul said during our meeting Wednesday in Toronto, where he lives. At a certain point, when the financial system is wrong, it falls apart. And it will fall apart again. And it kind of goes to a analysis of, you know, how the economic system, you know, the current phase of instability and the recent collapse, how it started, kind of the brief recent history of it. I won't go through that. It says, it was an understanding we can't have boom and bust cycles. Well, let me just read this. The collapse started in 1973, Saul continued. There were a series of sequential collapses afterwards. The fascinating thing is that between 1850 and 1970, we put in place all sorts of mechanisms to stop collapses, which we can call liberalism, social democracy, or red Toryism. It was an understanding that we can't have boom and bust cycles. We can't have poverty-stricken people. We can't have starvation. The reason today's collapses are not leading to what happened in the 18th century and 19th century is because all these safety nets, although under attack, are still in place. But each time we have a collapse, we come out of it stripping more of the protection away. At a certain point, we will find ourselves back in the pre-protection period. You know, that's like the late 19th century, early 20th century, with the rise of monopoly capitalism, the rapid industrialization, the rise of the, you know, the robber baron, the huge cartel, the huge monopolies of coal and steel, finance, and the basically totally unregulated capitalism. And at that point, when we find ourselves back in the pre-protection period, we will get a collapse that will be incredibly dramatic. I have no idea what it will look like. A revolution from the left? A revolution from the right? Is it violence followed by state violence? Is it the collapse of the last meaningful edges of democracy? Is it a sudden decision by a critical mass of people that they're not going to take it anymore? Those are the questions that Chris Hedges poses in this article, The Imperative of Revolt. This devolution of the economic system has been accompanied by corporation seizure of nearly all forms of political and social power. The corporate elite, through a puppet political class and compliant intellectuals, pundits, and press, still employs the language of a capitalist democracy. But what has arisen is a new kind of control, inverted totalitarianism, which Woolen brilliantly dissects in his book, Democracy Incorporated. Again, that's conversation that Chris Hedges was having with Sheldon Woolen, the author of this book I just mentioned. Inverted totalitarianism does not replicate past totalitarian structures such as fascism and communism. It is therefore harder to immediately identify and understand. There is no blustering demagogue. There is no triumphant revolutionary party. There are no ideologically drenched and emotional mass political rallies. The old symbols, the old iconography, and the old language of democracy are held up as virtuous. The old systems of governance, electoral politics, an independent judiciary, a free press, and the Constitution appear to be venerated. But similar to what happened during the late Roman Empire, all the institutions that make democracy possible have been hollowed out and rendered impotent and ineffectual. The corporate state, Woolen told me at his Oregon home, is legitimated by elections it controls. It exploits laws that once protected democracy to extinguish democracy. One example is allowing unlimited corporate campaign contributions in the name of our First Amendment right to free speech and our right to petition the government as citizens. It perpetuates politics all the time, Woolen said, but a politics that is not political. The endless election cycles, he said, are an example of politics without politics, driven not by substantive issues, but manufactured political personalities and opinion polls. There is no national institution in the United States that can be described as democratic. Again, I'm reading from The Imperative Revolt by Chris Hedges, published on Truth Dig, October 19th, just a few days ago. And again, the number here is 503-231-8187. If you'd like to talk about this, this is a subject that I've talked about previously. I had Norman Pollack on, who's a regular writer for Counterpunch. He was also talking about how he sees the United States as basically a functioning fascist entity, given the basically the how the merging of political and corporate power. Now, he's saying something a little different here. He's saying that it's not like previous forms, whether they be fascist or whatever. So I think that's something interesting, and it's probably why we are having a really serious trouble coming to grips with the present moment. So I think this article is really important, that there's something happening, and what it is ain't exactly clear. And we really need to get clear about it. And that's what we're trying to do here on KBOO. And I hope you are doing the same. And we need to get together in affinity groups, conversation groups, research groups, and work this out. I'm going to continue reading from this article. The mechanisms that once allowed the citizen to be a participant in power, from participating in elections to enjoying the rights of dissent and privacy, have been nullified. Money has replaced the vote, and corporations have garnered total power without using the cruder forms of traditional totalitarian control: concentration camps, enforced ideological conformity, and the physical suppression of dissent. They will avoid such measures, quote, as long as that dissent remains ineffectual. The government does not need to stamp out dissent. The uniformity of imposed public opinion through the corporate media does a very effective job. And I've come to the first page of this, and that's an opportune time to go to our first caller. Mark, you're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. Good Thanks morning. For your program and for taking my call. I totally agree with your analysis of our post-democracy, where revolving doors seem to have replaced checks and balances, that were threatened by a corporate neoliberalism. And to me, it really reaches an extreme in the new trade agreements that are being negotiated secretly. TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, is quite a scandal because it only allows corporations to sue the states. The states cannot sue corporations, and the decisions are irrevocable. A system of three-person courts and arbitration courts are set up, and they're actually staged. They take place in hotels. It's a private system. It's actually a parallel system of justice. Now, people in Europe are totally enraged and shocked, I think. There was an initiative, a European initiative, to stop the negotiations, but that failed. There are corporations like Philip Morris that are suing Australia and Uruguay for lost profits.
So, Mark, we've talked about this a certain amount on KBOO. I think there's at least a passing familiarity on our listeners. I think, you know, that what I really get back to, I don't want to beat people over the head. People have different perspectives, but it seems like we're not even at the place where we can challenge these things. So, you know, how do we get to the place where we can actually get together and challenge these things in the place where we live, here in wherever, you know, if you're, where are you calling from?
From downtown Portland.
Okay.
Yes. I'd like to interject a couple of positive notes. I watched an interview with John Paul Stevens on booktv.org. He's 94 years old, the second longest serving Supreme Court justice, and he plays tennis. He served from 1975 to 2010, and he dissented on Citizens United and said that maybe people in Michigan should keep non-Michigan money out of elections. It's so invigorating to hear him. Now, to me, booktv.org can change life into an open door, just like thementimeradio.org, where you can hear Bob Dylan, 100 of his Theme Time Radio programs. He talks about war, cops and robbers, work, nothingness. So I just recommend this.
Okay. So let me just repeat this question. Inverted totalitarianism. If the internal mechanisms that once made piecemeal and incremental reform possible remain ineffective, if corporate power retains its chokehold on our economy and governments, including our legislative bodies, judiciary, and systems of information, and if these corporate forces are able to use the security and surveillance apparatus and militarized police forces to criminalize dissent, how will change occur, and what will it look like?
I agree with a philosopher, Byung-Chul Han, who describes neoliberalism as psychopolitics and says that neoliberalism changes foreign exploitation into self-exploitation.
Right, but how will change occur and what will it look like? Those are the questions before us here.
Right. According to Hahn, only an explosion, only a great catastrophic event will change things.
We're going to wait for some sort of catastrophic event. We don't have to do anything ourselves. Is that what you're saying?
Well, he's very pessimistic.
I'm talking to you, though. I'm not talking about to this other person. I'm saying,
right.
What do you think?
Well, I'm committed to alternative economics. I'm committed to the idea that neoliberal model promotes profits, not investments.
Okay.
And
well,
it's very important to try to win a consensus, to try to awaken people. And I think that's our challenge. I just wanted to
A couple other callers, though.
Another link. It's titled OpportunityVillageEugene.com. They celebrated their one-year anniversary, and it's the cost is $3 a night.
Okay, so, great. Well, thank you very much for calling, Mark.
Thank you.
And we got a couple other calls. I really would like people to focus on this question before us. I think it's really difficult to focus on this because, you know, it's pretty intimidating, I guess. If the current structures in which we live are not capable of responding to the multiple crises, well, then what then do we do? How do we actually organize? So we have another caller. George, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. I bought a copy of Sheldon Wolin's Democracy Incorporated about a year and a half ago, and have been reading little bits of it now and then, and I think he's on a number of right tracks about the nature of the oppression. But your question is, what do we do? I think we have to work locally, and we have to try different things. This is recommended, by the way, in an interesting book called Marx's Ghost by a sociologist. A man who studied Marx for decades, and the ghost suggests, along the lines of Noam Chomsky's suggestion, that we have to decide what organizations are doing things that we think need to be done, and I think the suggestion is local is very important, and then we have to be prepared to make some serious sacrifices, possibly even of our lives. I would like to put in something about the framework, and this is something I notice doesn't happen on KBOO very much. But for a long time, and recently in a book called The Enigma of Capitalism by David Harvey, or The Enigma of Capital, Harvey pointed out the problem of the growth of capital worldwide over the last 200 years. And this is something that Marx stressed, that capital, as it grows, encounters increasing problems to realizing its profits, and these lead to new solutions and new oppression. This is one of the basic things, and we're in a time when capital has reached a point where it has saturated much of the world, and it is redoubling its efforts with disastrous effects on the environment and on social justice. And these are new things. We have to be prepared to struggle, not from the viewpoint of what the struggles of many, many decades and generations back, but we have to try to think of new ideas. And this idea of the growth of capital until it has reached a global systemic crisis, which is very plainly threatening the legitimacy in the consciousness of many people of the regime, is something I think that we need to look at. So I'll just leave it at that, and I think you have great ideas, and I think Sheldon Wolin has, and I read some of John Ralston Saul's things, and I'm going to read Chris Hedges' new book, and I think we have to be local, and we have to be very creative, and we have to be willing to reconceptualize, as Marty Hart Landsberg of Lewis and Clark has said. These are very important things. We can't see exactly what will be needed, but we have to be willing to get in there and put our bodies on the line, I think, in the coming years.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you so much.
And yeah, I'd like to, you know, one thing I've sort of wanted to talk about, since, you know, it's still, even though I'm making these exhortations towards, you know, organizing locally and being in place, forming some sort of bioregional network, it's still very in the abstract. And, you know, there are really good models, interesting models it's very difficult to organize in the kind of comprehensive way that we really need to form some sort of collective organization that goes beyond, you know, the single issues, which we sort of, you know, people talk about being siloed. That's kind of the catchword among activists, one of the catchwords now, that we're in our environmental and our social justice and our whatever silos. And so, you know, there was a very ambitious, interesting project in the early 1980s called the Alliance for Social Change, which brought together all the different so-called progressive or social change service organizations in the Portland metro area. And it lasted for a year or two. It was kind of top heavy. I think it had too much emphasis on fairly well-paid organizers and too much emphasis on big foundation grants and not enough kind of grassroots funded, kind of like, you know, union dues or dues to, you know, a grassroots political party or whatever other model, a social club dues kind of thing, which is, I think, really what we need to get to if we're going to have sustainable movement building. But it was a thing. It resulted in the Alliance newspaper and a few other projects that lasted. And the Alliance newspaper was one of the longest-running, perhaps the longest-running alternative newspaper in maybe in the country for lasted 30 years or more, until unfortunately it stopped publishing a couple of years ago. But the idea of an alliance of organizations, you know, some people say that's like herding cats, getting all these different activist organizations together. But, you know, that's the thing. We have to, we really have to confront each other on what the differences are that divide us. Who is there a we? Who is the agent? You know, these are big questions. We tend to assume that there's sort of a progressive movement or, you know, just like I was, we were criticizing the climate movement. We assume that there's some sort of movement. And when we assume that, a lot of times what happens is some of the same old forces of big money tend to come in and set the agenda and take it in a direction that might not be the direction we really need to go in, which is a direction of challenging those very old structures of decision-making and power to begin with. It's a conundrum, I admit, but looks like we've got a full slate of callers, so I'll stop talking. Perry, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, and thank you for taking my call. First, a comment, and then to your question. The comment is that you were talking about alliances and networking. And one of the, I want you to point to the KBOO website. That's a, I was hoping maybe you could maybe every morning for 2 or 3 minutes go through the website, because they do have an events calendar and all these different programs that are on KBOO that you could probably network together.
That's a great idea. I feel admonished. I agree. That's a good idea. I'll try to institutionalize that.
Oh yes, and there's a lot of us. There's a lot, probably a lot of listeners who don't have internet, so they really don't know what's on the website.
Fair enough.
And yeah, okay. And the next is to the question, labeling what is going on. I would probably call it democratic fascism. That probably be a good name for what's going on.
Hey, you know, everybody's it's an open field. I mean, there are identifiable features, obviously, but, you know, Chris Hedges is pointing to the fact that there's something different going on. Basically, what the system does is it mutates. It has to mutate because it always is overcoming new challenges, both from within and without. And so, yeah, it mutates and takes new forms. that then people have to, we have to respond to. And the problem is we're often dealing with it as if it's a form that is already superseded. And so it tends to escape our grasp.
Yes. And why the government can keep doing this is our, how economy works is now our government can print money. Right now, QE2 or QE3 is going on, and $88 billion is being printed every month. That's over close to $1 trillion a year. And if they have unlimited money, and so does the corporations, that's who end up getting it, there's no stop. That's why I think the collapse is going to be when people say, wait a minute, unlimited money, you can print anytime you want to?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, something to think about. So I think it has to do with, there'll probably have to be a complete collapse probably of our economy.
Well, you're the second person who said that. And, you know, I had Arun Gupta on last week, and he was warning against this idea of, the catastrophism tendency that there tends to be among a lot of environmentalists and a lot of people on the left, a lot of people on the right, this idea that... all we can do is wait till the system collapses, or there's climate change forces us to change our ways. But you know, my feeling is it's too late when that happens, because we already don't really have the solidarity and the social bonds that we had 100 years ago, because or 200 years ago or 300 years ago, because that's what the system does. It erodes those bonds, and it's those bonds that give us the ability to resist. And so, if when collapse happens, we're just going to be, it's going to be everyone for themselves. So I think we need to start now while we still have some form of room to maneuver. That's my view anyway.
Well, thank you for listening to my comment.
Okay.
Have a nice day.
Okay. Thanks for calling. And we have another caller. Nathan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
To the question again, I think I know less what to call the current system and what it is. I like the descriptions about inverted fascism,
inverted totalitarianism.
Thank you. What I do think a lot more about is how it will happen, how we will have essentially a revolution or a system change. And I think what it really requires is something that you were alluding to, which is building those connections that we need. And I think one thing that we need to do on the broader left is to institute not just thinking about it and publishing about it, which is very important, but also institute going door to door and talking to folks, or community to community, and really having those face-to-face, person-to-person interactions to have these discussions and to listen to people, because people are very, very radical and are very, very astute, and they see what's going on. And what the problem is that most of us don't know what to do. And most of us, I think, also kind of have a sense that the solution is some sort of popular action, but no one does a popular action by themselves. So I think that there's a lot of these intersections that already exist between environmentalism, between labor, between gender and a variety of other social politics. But most of the time, they are siloed because they're run by nonprofits, essentially. And a lot of these intersections happen individually, like within individuals themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we need to do is sure, do events and do a lot of these things, but we need to really, really have an eye to doing some serious grassroots organizing with the face to face or that sort of activity. And I think if, as long as we don't stay on that, we are always going to be trying to navigate social change in the avenues that are created by capital, like mass media or advertising. Or creating, more things that we're really not that strong at, that dominant forces are always going to be beating us at.
Yeah, Definitely, and I'd like to hear from people what they are actually doing and how they are making these intersections real in their organizing, and how we can expand that. And I would like to get more into, you know, into the nuts and bolts of like what people are actually doing, and what sort of projects are going on, as well as talking, you know, more in the abstract of what we're doing. But I think it's important because I think our imaginations themselves have become fettered, and so we need to talk about it to, you know, help us see other possibilities. But anyway, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
Okay. And so one thing, you know, I've talked about in the past also is, you know, I lived in Italy for many years, and some people have an idea of, you know, that some European countries are way ahead of us on some things, and they sometimes kind of tend to romanticize things. But the reality is, yeah, there's some really interesting, you know, there's still like in Italy and some other European countries, although it's unraveling fast, the whole what Chris Hedges is talking about, the whole welfare state social net, the same thing is happening there is happening here, but it lasted a lot longer. You know, public health system and stuff like that still is more intact in as it, well, it's never really been here, a serious public health system. But so anyway, in Italy, you know, they had actually left parties, strong left parties that were a counterweight to the dominant capitalist parties. And that provided some space for really a counterweight and created a greater social net, because the powers had to give in more. And, you know, that happened here through the 1930s after the Great Depression and FDR and all the creation of our social net in response to the inability of the capitalist system to regulate itself. In any case, there were these social centers. I think I've talked about that a little bit. These the communist and socialist parties and the Christian Democrat and others had their own social centers in all, you know, cities and towns that were basically places to go to. There was a bar, maybe a restaurant, meeting spaces, and people would go and do their political activity and their social activity. And we don't really have, you know, there might be the corner bar here, used to be, you know, we have cafes, but I don't know how much political discussion really goes in bars and cafes. Like, you know, basically an ongoing, you know, where you see the same people and you actually like talk about things in an effective, useful way, where you're actually really engaged in what's going on in your town and really, you know, actually having conversations that could have some effective result. But there, you know, they had these social centers, and, you know, when the whole kind of the new left came in, and there was a critique of the old communist party kind of fell into disfavor among the young, talking about the 60s and 70s. So young people occupied abandoned buildings and created occupied social centers, kind of similar on the sort of the model of their parents or whatever, but very different and much more democratic and participatory, in the sense that they created it themselves directly and utilized unutilized spaces. Now, the power of property, we tend to accept the power of property in the United States because it's a given. It seems immutable and unchallengeable. But, you know, we have to, sooner or later, I believe, come up against the power of property itself. And I know people after Occupy, both in D.C. where I was, I didn't participate in here. I was in Washington, D.C. area where I'm originally from. And I heard people talking about this here in Portland after, in the aftermath of Occupy, that people were talking about the need to actually occupy some actual building. People did one symbolic action in D.C. I don't really know if people did much here, but, you know, those are interesting things. I can't myself advocate anything like that on the air, of course, because those things are illegal. One cannot illegally break into a private building and try to occupy it. But I think those are interesting things to look at and discuss amongst us. So I could just go on, but we do have another full slate of callers, and we only have 10 minutes left. So, Jack, you're on the air.
Hi, I'll be really quick. I've been listening to you talk the last couple segments about just different things like the social space and, or sorry, the social hub, I think you were saying, and about newspapers and kind of lamenting those things. And I think that, you know, the way that change will come about is, and essentially what's replaced all these things is the Internet. And I think if you look at, you know, the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement, they're really still being kept alive, even though they're not in a physical space anymore, through the ideas on the Internet. And I think another part of that is just how international all the, you know, the corporatism is and the corporate fiefdom. It's international, so we got to go international. And I think the Internet is the way to do that, just kind of break down the wall. It's not just an American problem. It's a global problem.
Yeah, but it has to. We can't stay on the Internet, and it has to take place in some physical space. You know, in the Arab Spring countries, people actually occupied plazas that actually, you know, the squares, Tahrir Square or wherever, and actually directly challenged power. You know, physically challenged power. So I think the challenge remains: how does it come off the Internet and into public space?
Yeah, I don't know if it necessarily would have to come into a physical space. People changing their habits and changing, like, I don't know, I think, like, as a global problem, like, if you look at climate change, like, if people just do things individually, you know, if as long as they're connected through the Internet or connected through some sort of means but acting separately, I think there's a power in people acting separately but also, you know, thinking together. I think that's probably what the next wave will look like.
Because I guess I would lump that myself, and I don't, you know, no offense, but I talked about like magical thinking or stinking thinking that they talk about in AA. I would lump that there personally. I mean, you know, so how does that actually, you know, what give me the, tell me the steps. Okay, say in 10 years, look down the road 10 years and we've like solved the climate crisis. Well, you got to tell me, how did people just acting individually, how did that actually make the change? You know, it has to be described. There has to be, you know, this actually has to take place in reality. So, you know, we have to really think seriously. What are things can actually get to the kind of changes we want to make?
Well, I guess it would just be like a global change as far as, you know, the thoughts are changing. You know, people can kind of peep through the cloud of the message that's being presented by the corporate media, and then they take individual action, so they no longer, you know, use certain products. They no longer...
What's so easy to say, but it's not happening now. So why do we think that it's actually going to happen? It's definitely not happening now.
I think it is happening now.
We keep pumping more carbon dioxide in the environment every day, you know, and we're already past 400 particles per million, and we're already seeing the signs of human forced climate change. That's not slowing down. I just don't see it.
Well, I just don't see what the benefit of, you know, coming together in a physical space to do something physical, when if you had 100 people together, one tank could take them all out. But if you had people thinking like, why do police organizations have tanks? Then you can take away the enemy's weapons if, you know, public opinion makes them have to get rid of their tanks. Like if you look at a situation like this, UC Day, or, you know, in Davis, in California, they had a tank and they got rid of it because it just became so unpopular. Like, there's these news stories. Now there's the police organizations they're going to have to do something about it because there's bad press on the police right now. And that's what the Internet does. It brings these stories that were previously, you know, on page, you know, the back pages of the newspaper. It brings them to the front page and it makes them address them.
That could be, you know, we'll see. But we have a couple other callers, and I thank you for calling.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Have a good one. Bye.
Okay, bye. So we have another caller. Dale, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, Paul. It seems to me like things are just getting worse and worse, and maybe the only possible recourse might be something like what's called comedic license. If you think about things like the Stephen Colbert report, and maybe the Boo needs to take a look at whether it might be possible to have a maybe a nonverbal clown explain to me if there is someone, a name on the ballot that I can count on to not go to work for the Eric and work against my best interests. And it's just something that the Boo does not dare. It's like the cartoon from Callahan years ago where the woman behind the counter is telling the customer that this is a feminist bookstore and there is no humor section here.
Okay. Well, I do believe we... That's a good suggestion. I've always thought that we should have more humor on KBOO. During the day, there is some in the evening sometimes. But we'll take that into consideration. I appreciate your calling.
In the meantime, I have a friend coming over with a computer. And what website would I use to find out if there is someone I can vote for?
Okay. Well,
do you happen to know?
Someone you can vote for?
Yeah, yeah. Is there a website that would help me find out? Does the KBOO website have
I don't know. I'm not really familiar with that. I mean, I've basically read the voter's pamphlet myself. I know that my engineer Steve is mentioning go to the Scanner News. Scanner. I don't know. I don't know about that, but that's one suggestion. But we're running out of time. We've only got a couple minutes left, so I thank you for calling.
All right.
And I just want to mention before we go, Winona LaDuke is coming to Portland. She's speaking this evening. I did see that it was possibly sold out, even though it's a free event that I guess people pre-registered for. So I don't know about that, but it's for the National Campus Sustainability Day, and they've changed the venue to Peter Stott Center to get more people. That's at 930 Southwest Hall in downtown Portland on the Portland State Campus. She's a member of the Mississippi Band of the White Earth Reservation of the Anishinaabe Nation. She is a really great speaker, so... go online to PSU. Maybe you can find out if it's true that there's no room left, but or just go down there and take a shot. So this is Sustainability Week or Month. The PSU Institute for Sustainable Solutions is working in conjunction with the Native American Student and Community Center and the Indigenous Nations Studies Department to develop a series of learning opportunities during LaDuke's visit. So check that out and keep listening here to KBOO Community Radio throughout the day and the week. Appreciate your listening. My name's Paul Rowland. I'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
All I want to be something fancy, nothing special, but just a priority. Just a fantasy. It's not the way to be. You've got a violent, lazy life. Nursery rhyme is really like a politician's speech. It makes as much sense as counting pebbles on a beach. And if you don't believe me, then check the manifesto. Just blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. The truth, I don't think so. All I wanna be, something fancy. Nothing special, but just a priority. Just step back and see, it's not the way to be. You've gotta find a place in life. All I wanna be, something fancy.
Tune in to KABU on Wednesday, October 22nd at 6 p.m. for a spooky, spectacular radio show hosted on the KABU Youth Collective. You'll hear pieces about haunted places, creepy animals, scary songs, and other things we find spooky and spectacular. That's Wednesday, October 22nd at 6 p.m. on your community station, KBOO Portland.
You better duck when I show up.
Good morning, it's 9 o'clock. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Time now for Political Perspectives, where we hear excerpts from Ballotpalooza reports and debates on Oregon ballot measures by City Club of Portland members. And at 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter speaks with Todd Walters of the Policy Center for Environment and Peace, Conservation International, about environmental peacemaking, and George Ahumada, technical director of the Team Network Conservation International, about his work on solving applied conservation problems. And thank you, KABU members, for supporting your community radio station, KBOO Portland. We really appreciate it. So, coming up first, we're going to hear excerpts from Ballotpalooza. It's a forum sponsored by the City Club of Portland for debate and discussion on Oregon ballot measures. For 4 months, 9 committees made up of City Club member volunteers studied proposed Oregon ballot measures. On August 20th, the club held this forum to present the committee's reports and debate the issues. We'll hear excerpts from the discussion on Ballot Measure 86, the higher education scholarship bonds, Ballot Measure 88,